Ready? 31 seconds. I'll start with Q anyways there, Grace, you can hold on. You have to pull your mic close to you because it's not that great. All right, that was A Tribe Called Red. We're giving away tickets to A Tribe Called Red today. In studio with me.
Dante. Thank you. Dante, Gapapamas Gamganak Esquayo, Natsigasun, Otsinia, Michelle First Nation, Niahonoshoni Nihau Esquayo. Hello, my English name is Jody Callahoo Stonehouse. I'm from the Michelle First Nation. We are Cree and Mohawk peoples. And what you saw there was a clip from Achimowin. Achimowin is Cree for let's talk, let's share, let's come together with our hearts and minds, and let's tell stories. So, storytelling essentially. And approximately 5.5 years ago, Isabel Okanese, the founder of Achimowin, brought protocol to me. And she said, CJSR is going to lose its Aboriginal content. And it is the longest standing Aboriginal show produced and founded and broadcasted by Aboriginal people. And if you don't take it, we're not going to have it. And I was like, oh, I've never done radio. I don't know. I think you're crazy. Hi, I'll do it. So I accepted the protocol and started my crash test into radio. And so that's how I began my journey in radio. I need to give some acknowledgments as I sit here and share this great production and the team that I work with. Chris, who's here from CJSR, I am pulled in many different directions in my community and here at the University of Alberta and with the City of Edmonton, and I wouldn't be able to do the radio without the support of the people at CJSR and Chris, especially you, so thank you. Because I'm here today is because of Chris. So thank you, Chris. Also, thank you to the hosts of this event today. This is really important stuff that we're talking about, Indigenous peoples and broadcasting and how that will be reflected in the future. So thank you for coming together and doing this, Gretchen. It was great to see you. Thank you for the invitation. So revitalizing Indian storytelling in the media. Why the word Indian to begin with? Well, I'm going to tell you a little story. I have a beautiful friend named Tanya Capo, and she came to me about 2 years ago and said, Jody, I've met with some people. They're interested in the CRTC process and applying for what used to be the Aboriginal Voices radio license. And I was like, are you crazy? We sat over time and talked about it, and she had met with a friend of hers, Ranjit, and they are a different Indian. They are the Dot Indian. And so over the past year and a half, we came together talking about how Columbus was looking for you, but he found me, and how did the Dot and Feather come together to talk about our indigeneity, to talk about our relationship as people who've been here all along and people who've come here. How do we talk about our relationship with settlers, and how do we know each other, and how do we not know each other? And out of those conversations really blossomed some beautiful friendships, and we were able to come up with an application for a CRTC license together under VMS. And I don't think they were prepared for us, and I wasn't prepared for them. That is quite a process in itself. You know, when you think about yourself as just this small campus radio kid trying to love her people and lift her people, to going to flying to Ottawa, bringing her smartest friends and saying, let's do this. And I want to thank you, Christopher Peters and Bradley Williams, for coming and participating on that panel, and also Jeremiah Meniopes, also known as Dreesus, who supported our CRTC application. And what we did is we brought our perspective as young Indigenous peoples, as young leaders. Christopher's a civil engineer, Bradley does lots with communication and radio, and Dreesus is an Indigenous performer. And how can we as Indigenous people in contemporary times talk about why radio is relevant and important to us. How can we bring it further into our communities? Particularly, we are concerned with the young people in foster care. We have 30,000 Aboriginal kids in foster care, more than there ever was in the Indian residential schools. And in Alberta, we had the highest rate of Indian residential schools in all of Canada. And that means for us, we have the most work to do as Indigenous peoples, which means reclaiming our languages, reimagining our Indigenous future, reclaiming our Indigenous legal traditions, asserting them. And what a great tool to do all of that is radio. And our people love radio because we're story people. We come from the oral tradition. And similarly to our relatives who Columbus was looking for, their people love stories. Their people also love the radio. And so it just was this great opportunity to come together to share some time on the radio. And we also strategized around shared content. How can we share the airwaves together to break down some stereotypes, to build relationships, and to imagine the greatest Canada possible through a brown lens? And so that was some of what we did. And I want to send a big thank you to Tanya Capo, who had the vision and the tenacity to push me to do that. Reconciliation. What is reconciliation? Reconciliation is often the new word that I hear. I see lots of institutions having boxes to check around what reconciliation looks for each of them. I see cities doing it across the nation, learning institutions, educational institutions, how do we change curriculum? But for me, I wonder, what is the work that we have to do as Indigenous peoples? How do we reconcile with our own trauma? How do we reconcile with the state? How do we forgive? How do we move past our own injury? And for me, part of that work is radio. It's loving ourselves, celebrating ourselves, and uplifting ourselves. So giving us a platform, not giving, claiming that platform as a space for us to do all of that work. And it is work. And some of the work that I've been blessed to be a part of here on the radio is that station. So Atchimawin, the show itself, has been a huge success, not because of anything I've done, but because the people have embraced it. The community have loved it, and they have lifted it. What I was able to facilitate was a safe space. When I started, I was like, I can't do this alone. And so I reached out, starting with young people at iHuman. And when they wanted to record hip-hop songs, I was like, let's do this. And then we started to film things. And then we started to tweet things. And then we started to Instagram things. And young people are so innovative and clever. It didn't take long for this to become a winning formula that soon people at CBC were reaching out and other radio stations were reaching out, like, how did you do this? Why are you doing this? And it just became a natural way of connecting with our outside relatives, because as we saw during the Idle No More crisis, we were able to mobilize and we were able to have connection with each other through social media. So it was just a natural fit that social media would play such a strong role in radio. So the young people helped the vision of Atchimawin become more than just radio. It became a social media station. The beautiful thing about ourselves as Indigenous people is we're very complex and we're very layered. And so there's never a dull moment and we're never lacking in content. Between our artists, our politicians, our storytellers, our elders, there's always something rich and wonderful to share with people. And the controversial stuff is just as important. You know, when we're having conversations around sports teams and mascots, the idea of the Edmonton Eskimos, is that an appropriate name to be using here for a sports team? That's a conversation we started having, and it wasn't a positive one or one that people really liked to connect to, but we had it nonetheless. And so wrestling with those really tough notions and concepts are just as important as talking about all the beautiful, wonderful things that are also happening. So we try to use this, and when I say we, there are many moving parts of a Chimowan, and those are community members. I have elders who often come and tell me, Jody, you need to talk about this on your radio. And so we do. We do talk about that. Or academics who will call me and say, I'm coming into town. Can I come on the show? Absolutely. Please come on the show. And so the beautiful thing about a Chimowan creating momentum is that people call to come on the show because they want to share what they're doing, because they see the social media is engaging, the Twitter feeds, the Facebook Live feeds. More recently, we just posted Facebook Live, and there was over 2,500 people watching. I was like, oh, who watches this? Don't you people have to work? But the beautiful thing is that our people's stories are getting out there, whether it be through the radio airwaves or through some of our innovative strategies. One of the things that I try to focus on and keep reiterating throughout A Chimowan's Time is that this is a space for queer people. As Indigenous peoples, colonization has brought a lot of shame to our indigeneity around our queerness, and so how do we embody and share that in a good way, in a loving way, and in a respectful way? And so that's been really critical, as well as Indigenous feminism. How do we talk about that? How do we share that? And how do we just be that? How do we be an Indigenous feminist radio station and take down colonialism? I have many people to thank. I would not be able to be here without mentors or people who supported me along the way. And I love the work of Molly and Chelsea, who you heard from earlier, in Métis in Space. Ryan McMahon, who's been a great big brother through his Red Man Laughing and Stories on the Land. And just how political can you be without somebody firing you? And I guess when you're your own boss, you can't really get fired. So the beauty in watching others really push the line has made space for the rest of us to follow and have those really critical conversations. So when I use the term revitalizing Indian storytelling, I don't think that's true in any way. I don't think our stories have ever stopped being told. I don't think they've ever stopped. What I think I'm able to do with the Chimowan is put my elbows out a little bit and make some space around for people to hear those stories. And so it might be more like wrestling as opposed to revitalizing, because our stories are there. They've always been there. And there's more coming. And the beautiful thing about Indigenous storytelling is that there's our creation stories, right? And there's keepers of those stories. And then there's stories that build on those creation stories that tell us how to act as human beings and how we should be responsible and what our obligations are. And then now we have contemporary stories, which, you know, really bring us to the current realities. And they come from various storytellers. And the beautiful thing about radio is we can make space for all of these storytellers. And so part of my work is creating a space that's safe enough and welcoming enough. So that means offering protocol when necessary, going to see people, building relationships with people so that they trust me. And then it has a ripple effect. If you see so-and-so trusts her, then I'll go see her too. Because I think some of the biggest hurdles have been getting women to come in. Men seem not to have less of an issue sharing their greatness on the radio or on film. But I was like, where are my women at? And part of it was they're working multiple jobs, raising kids and taking care of more work than some of the male counterparts. But another piece of it was the confidence piece. And so how could I, as an Indigenous woman, support and nurture them so that they would feel safe and loved while they come in studio and share their stories and feel worthy that their story should be shared? This wasn't in all cases, but certainly a lot of the grassroots work was about nurturing people to feel that there was a place for them there in studio. So for me, the root of success for A Chimowan has been in relationships. There's nothing more critical or important for this program than the relationships that I've been able to establish with communities, with leadership, and with institutions as well. More recently, Minister Richard Feehan, Minister of Indigenous Relations, reached out and said, "Can I please come on your radio show?" And I was like, I'm gonna be really tough on you. Are you sure?" So I think that's exciting when our politicians think that that my place is a safe place for them, because little do they know I'm gonna ask some hard-hitting questions. And that's the other thing, is that it is fun and loving, but it's also, let's get to the work of it. Let's get to the critical things that we need to be talking about. Because in order for Canada to make change, in order for our people to live in less marginalized spaces, we have to have these conversations, and they're uncomfortable. And radio is a great place to have those, because while we're having those conversations, other people start having conversations, and then others will start having conversations. And so I see it as a way to build momentum for change. Canada is celebrating 150 years. For me, when we went forward to Ottawa to apply for the CRTC license, it was about how do we imagine the next 150 years. It was an Aboriginal license that we applied for, and we partnered with an ethnic community. So they would have 40% of the content, we would have 50% of the content, and we would together have our 10% shared content. And that was risky, going, I know already our voice is marginalized, and what right did I have to go after that license and share it with another community? So that was really tough for me to make that decision, and I brought it to ceremony because I felt it wasn't just a decision that I could make and that I needed support in making that. And then I brought it to the community and to friends and colleagues, and then we made the decision to go forward with this. And I'm grateful that we did, because what I experienced was disappointing. The radio stations that had put forward their content, what I experienced was a maintaining of the status quo, which is we will play typical content and then we will add 10 to 15% of Indigenous content, just being music. Our Indigenous music is very important, but so are our conversations, so are our stories, so are our legal traditions, and nobody was talking about those things, and nobody had made space for unpaid time, so for community members to come in and do language programming, which we found, you know, to be foundational and critical. We allocated 20% of our resources to be in community, developing with community members what they think they needs to be on the radio, whether it's a story from an elder or a young person wants to do a hip hop track, whatever it is they imagine for themselves, we will support and fund. And nobody else had made space to do that. For me, that's disheartening, considering the statistics of our youth, our suicide rate, when we look at our school dropout rates, when we look at our incarceration rates. The reality is we need to do things differently, and upholding the status quo is not good enough anymore. So for me, partnering with VMS, I didn't have multitudes of choices, people coming forward to say, "Let's partner, let's support, let's do this." They, in fact, were the only partner, and I am grateful for the blessing that they provided us so that we as young people could do some things differently. Part of thinking around creating a radio station here in Edmonton and in Calgary was thinking about the governance. Who would make the decisions? Who would be in charge? And that was really easy for us, and it was, you need an elders governance council, right? Our elders, and if that works for you as well, from your South Asian community, then that's how we see it, is we need to have our elders advising us, as well as a youth committee. There's no way you can move forward without hearing from the past and imagining with the future together. And so those are our two governing bodies, and we work for the people, and how they imagine the future of radio is what we would be obliged to implement. So that is the work that I did with the CRTC application. Radio is vital to our language survival. Our language is dying, there's no question. And so how can we make our language accessible? How do we make it fun? How can we create ways that not only our own people, but settlers want to speak our language? How do we invite others to be a part of this community? That's part of the work, is that we've been siloed for so long. How can we bridge that relationship? How do we invite settlers to want to speak our language? How do we invite settlers and immigrants to be a part of these conversations? Where is their role in all of this? Because if we're going to reconcile and make Canada a better nation, we have to do it together. And so that's part of the work around language, is that it just can't be in a specific language, that we actually have to have translation throughout, and we have to make it exciting and engaging, and so that typical people listening to the radio want to listen, want to participate, and are learning our languages. So there's a lot of work ahead of me and others in strategizing on how to move forward, and there's some brilliant young people who have the skill set to do all of this, and I'm grateful to know many of them, and I look forward to working with them. And I'm happy to be here because I'm looking forward to some really important questions that help me think forward around where are we going from here? Where is Achimwin going to go from here? And part of the work has been mentorship. I've brought on countless young people. I lost one to CFWE. She was recruited there. I've lost one to APTN. He was recruited there. I've lost two to Community Radio in Calgary. So the work that I've been doing with them, translates into other work that they can do, which is kind of a beautiful gift. And from radio, we are able to engage in film, and then we're able to engage in social media. And from the filming that we did, we had six young people, and they actually created a youth documentary, and they worked in and around the radio, and then they created a youth documentary film, and that film won 5 awards in Washington State, and it's called Journey Towards Reconciliation. And so radio has been a platform, the roots of many other projects with young people, and I imagine it will continue to be that for Indigenous peoples, is a place for them to really water and nurture their spirits and their imagination around where they want to go in the future. So that's all that I have written. And I would be really more than happy to answer questions and to have dialogue with all of you around what you think about Indigenous radio and questions around the CRTC process.
Thank you. Thank you, Jody. Do people have questions or comments to start the conversation? I'll bring the microphone closer if you give me a minute, just maybe.
So if this license application is successful, that's going to take a lot of people to be the voices on air. What pools are you hoping to tap into for that?
That's a great question, Chris. So the beautiful thing is that there's already community radio programming happening in local communities around here. And so part of that would be partnering with them as well, making space on a broader scale. So if we look at in Calgary, for example, in Morley, they have Siktogija, which is run out of Morley. So being able to take that content and provide it on a bigger scale. There's stuff happening in Blackfoot territory down in Piikani. There's stuff Eagle and Hawk out at Musquechee. So taking these already established radio stations and syndicating some of their stuff. The other piece is building on what young people are already doing with their podcasting, making space for Métis in Space and Ryan McMahon, as well as part of it is going to be recruiting and encouraging elders to come forward and making that space for them to be on the radio as well. It's going to be a lot of work. We did come up with a program schedule that was posted online for the application, so you're free to look at that, and that might answer some more of your questions there. Thank you, Chris.
Do you want to mention the website? You mentioned that it's online.
The CRTC website, sorry.
So if you look up CRTC 2017-1, you can look at all the applications, including VMS's application for a license. So CRTC 2017-1.
Yes.
Other questions, conversation?
Thanks for your presentation. It's radio's a lot of fun, actually. And it looks like you're having fun making it. How did you feel about the CRTC process? Like the license application process and then I guess there were hearings and I'm talking about CRTC process in the next panel because I've been involved in making applications and then studying it for a number of years. And I think sometimes there can be a real disconnect for people sort of moving into that really formal legal and bureaucratic space. So I'm just curious how you found it going through all those motions.
Thank you, Michael, for your question. Well, how did I feel about it? So if I talk about how I feel, I felt intimidated. I felt nervous. I felt humbled, particularly Bert Crowfoot, who was there, who's the pioneer of Indigenous radio in this territory, to go against someone who you respect immensely was difficult and not easy. I felt that the process itself was very removed from Indigenous processes. It's very much based on sort of a Canadian juridical model. The process itself is not connected to peoplehood or the ways in which our people hold one another responsible. I felt that the process didn't actually look at what people were really going to be able to offer. As much as we tried to provide a view into that, I don't think that they actually have a clear picture of what the potential is. I don't think that process enables that. And I can't think off the top of my head what would allow or facilitate that, but I don't think that process does that. And so maybe some of the work might be, how do we reimagine it from an Indigenous lens? And how can Indigenous peoples participate and how they decide what is relevant for them insofar as Indigenous radio? Does that answer your question? Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name's Rob McMahon. I'm an assistant prof here at U of A. And I had a couple questions, actually. One was, I was curious about, you have those governance committees, so you had the governance committee of elders and one of youth. And I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure.
It sounded like a fantastic idea, so I was just curious to learn about that. And then my other question was just around, I also loved how you have like these things that kind of emerge from your radio program. So you've got the social media, you've got the video, like stuff like that. And I was wondering, like, you know, from your experience with the CRTC, do you think it's too, I don't know how to put this, like, it seems to have focused on radio broadcasting, but do you think are things changing as we go digital? Like, is it changing the game at all from your perspective as somebody who's producing in these different mediums?
The CRTC, absolutely things are changing with the digital, and I see that in, there was a analytics done by Right Relevance, and in there they did a Twitter analysis of popularity or most retweets, and Atchimwin ranked number one in Alberta as the most influential First Nations voice organization and number four nationally, and that wasn't based on anything other than the social media engagement, which is indicative of the relationship between radio and social media, because I'm not on the social media unless I'm on the radio. So we're tweeting live, talking to listeners live, which talks about how this digital relationship has shifted radio. And when the CRTC called for an innovative application, to me, when I think about innovation, it's about how are these typical systems shifting? So that system of radio is shifting with the digital era, right? And engaging through Twitter, for me, was one of the innovations that we use, along with Instagram, all of the social media outlets, Facebook Live, YouTube, so generating radio after the fact, so creating YouTube programs that are published based on the radio programming is also another element of being innovative. So it has shifted. Okay, the second part of your question around governance. So what that looks like is having elders who are interested and invested in radio, and young people also in the same, and not just radio, but musicians. So going out to community and offering protocol and talking about who keeps the songs, who is the keeper of the stories, who has the rights to share this, because in our communities there are rights holders. And so making sure that you go about that process in the best possible way is really critical and important. And it's been vital to the survival of my work, because if it's not done properly, you can get shut down really fast through the community, and that can be done through social media. You know, I've been really blessed and grateful so far to so far be supported in that way. And so with the young people, for me, it's been about accessing the young people who are at risk. So working in partnership with places like iHuman Youth Society, as well as Moving the Mountain. There was a group of 25 young girls, and you'll see on my Instagram feed, you know, three of them were continuously coming in the radio station with me, being my co-host, sitting on, they're everywhere, and we're on the mic, and, you know, and those young people, you know, they maybe articulate things in really volatile and angry ways initially, but over time it becomes a bit softer and a bit more comprehensible, and with a little bit of love you can pull out a really beautiful program with them. And it took probably 8 months of really tough work and don't swear on the radio stuff, you can't say that, and you're 3 hours late, to somebody who's really invested, to somebody who wants to take a lead, to somebody who wants to have their own show. But it means actually doing that ugly work with young people. And then there's young people who are looking to do radio already, who are doing very well, and they are critical in that development as well. So because we are complex, because 50% of us are urban, 50% of us are in rural communities, how do we ensure that both those voices are heard and have a place and space in that governance model? And that's part of the work of that, is to make sure there's space for all of us, including the non-treaty, including Métis people and Inuit people, because all of our voices matter, so we have to make space for all of them. Does that answer your question? And you can see also on our application the more formal process of how people are selected.
I just want to engage you with the people of Iqaluit in a small way, because one of the things you mentioned was about translation. So that we have different people engaged. But over there was a comment about translation making people lazy. And so that if you had English translation, then you're still losing the language because your eye is forced down to the subtitles or whatever. So I was just wondering if you had thought about that and what your thoughts are. And also, earlier I asked this question to the other ladies who are here, so I'll ask you the same one. How do you think the CRTC could better engage youth in policymaking, in their processes? I know you mentioned in your organization, if you were awarded the license, but in getting them to engage in policy, which is my struggle as a professor to get students engaged. So how do you do that in, you know, every day?
Thank you for your questions, Genevieve. Translation, part of that is yes, and part of that is because we did have the highest amount of Indian residential schools here in Alberta, we have the highest rate of language loss. And so part of it is, how do we navigate that space so that we are lifting the language and celebrating our language speakers, but also inviting those who lost it, A, in the school process, or B, intergenerationally, because we want to bring those listeners into the conversations. And so for us in the North, the majority of them still speak the language, and so I can definitely see how it would bring about that notion of laziness. I think we could get there over time, but we need some time to repair and reclaim our languages, to reintroduce some of the words and themes and notions and those stories in the language. And then, of course, the goal would be to have fluent conversations that we wouldn't need translations. And how do we go about doing that? Do we be innovative and have it just in the language? And then we talked about sending, you know, subtitles or online or through Twitter. How can we do that interactively? Those are some of the ways we're going to have to do some testing. What's working? What's our prototype? What's different? What's working here? What's not working in this territory? So that will take, you know, us going into a think tank, creating 4 different prototypes and sending them out and testing them and scaling them, right, from small to large. What, you know, if it's successful, let's go big. So that's kind of my thoughts around that question. The CRTC engagement with youth. Well, it was terrifying for me because it's a lot of language, a lot of content, and I need to thank the people who helped read some of the stuff, Brad and Christopher, because I wasn't able to process. So they supported in that, okay, they read it, and then we talked about it, because it just isn't as easy as reading something and making sense of it, because the application process in itself felt like a whole nother language to me. And translating what is meant and what is actually being asked took some talking, and we had to get a lawyer to help, as well as Tanya as a lawyer herself, to make sense of this for me, because it's not clear to me. And so if we're thinking about engaging youth, which I think is really critical and important, we have to do some translation pieces. We have to make it accessible, and we have to make it legitimate in their own realities. Why does this matter, right? Why does this matter to you as young Indigenous people? Well, it can do this, this, and this for you. And so that's going to take a lot of work on us and some strategizing around making it. I think the most important thing is accessible and relevant. And it is really important and relevant to their lives, because they love the radio. They create beautiful programming when given the microphone. Many of them are interested in recording, whether it be hand drum songs or hip hop songs, or they're on. If we look at YouTube and look up Indigenous youth, they are creating homemade videos for 100 years. You know, they are doing it already. So how do we take what they're doing and make it seem relational to the CRTC application is going to be a bit of work, but it's important work. Did that answer? Okay, great.
Other questions?
A brief comment that was just sort of triggered for me around the question of translation. Most of my experience with Indigenous communities comes from Northwest British Columbia and later with more northerly places. But a pivotal moment in my life was attending a Gik'san Niska overlap feast in 1985 and hearing the Adak recited in the language with simultaneous translation, which allowed me to hear the eloquence and incredible dramatic presentation of the elders who were the keepers of those histories, while also knowing what they said. And because it wasn't exactly at the same moment, I could use my baby steps Gik'san and try to understand some of the words, and then I would have it kind of confirm for me what they'd actually said. And I don't know if you could apply that to radio, but it was a very profound experience for me in terms of dealing with ways to go about translation and so on. It required, of course, some very people with very high-level language skills in both languages to be able to do that simultaneous oral translation. And they were using, in those days, little earphone things like they used to use in the UN. And I don't know if you could do that to radio, but I just wanted to share that experience in terms of thinking about translation.
Thank you, Leslie. What a gift to hear the Adawak recited. What a beautiful thing you got to experience. And, you know, I don't know that we would be able to do that on radio, but that would be optimal to be able to share creation stories in that same powerful light of it being a spiritual moment and a profound moment, but in a way that others can hear it that can't speak the language. And so that would be the ultimate goal, is to have that kind of work translate through the radio waves. I don't know how to do it yet, but I'm sure it's possible. Thank you for that.
Other questions or comments?
if you're just brainstorming like ways to do something neat like that to let people connect with important texts in those two languages, like we at CJSR, we have students each semester from U of A classes do radio documentaries with us, and we have had students do stuff in multiple languages at once with either dubbing or interpretation after the fact. Also, there's lots of opportunities on radio to do sort of like mini pieces, little tiny pieces that hosts can play when they need something to fill like two minutes or 4 minutes. So if there's a bit of that text, like for example, on our queer program, Gay Wire, they have a little tiny segment called Queeros, and whenever they need like a minute to like shuffle papers before they come back on air, they play one of these pre-recorded segments where they play a quote from a queer hero. So that might be an opportunity to present something like that, is to produce some pre-recorded little snippets of a text like that. Yeah, just an idea.
Just to say that technology is actually getting there. I was at a conference in Europe in the fall, and there are people actually working on this to be able to do it like with your iPhone or whatever. So even though something on the air is in one language, you could actually convert it on your phone or whatnot. So they're working on it. So it's coming.
We'll go for one more. I was just, okay, when you were talking about sort of community visits, I think that's an important piece that maybe the CRTC missed in when we're thinking about reviewing the native broadcasting policy. I think that's imperative, that same face-to-face conversation happens. We are an oral peoples. We like to visit and we like to see the people who are making those changes, and I think that face-to-face contact is critical. And you reminded me that when speaking about going out into community and doing those conversations. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you so much, Jodi. Okay. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Fabulous. And thank you for your contributions.
I have to apologize. I'm working on the World Indigenous Nations Games. We're bringing over 35 countries here to Edmonton and Enoch. We're playing Indigenous games, traditional games, spear chucking, swimming in the river, canoeing. We have all kinds of games that we're working on. They'll be here July 2nd to 9th in Enoch, and I want to extend an invitation to all of you. But I apologize, I must leave because we are in the midst of making sure everyone's visas go through, and there's a lot of responsibility on my shoulders, and I must get back to work. So I apologize, but thank you for making the space today for me to share a little bit of what I do with the Chimoan. So hi, hi, miigwech.
We're going to talk about the CRTC Native Broadcasting Policy for the next 30 minutes and then start our panel at 2, I believe it is. Or, that's not right, is it 2:30? Yes, so we have until 2:15 and we'll take a little break. Does everybody have a copy of the Native Broadcasting Policy? It's the one that has all the numbers, the line counting. I'll bring, does anybody need a copy in English?
Okay.
This is just the determinations of the policy. So if you've looked, does anybody else need a copy? Yep, I'll get you one.
Yep.
Look, you're on it.
Thank you again.
Basically, while still running, the idea is so for us to, you can re-familiarize yourself with it if you're already familiar with the policy, if you've never read it, you can read into it.
So, again, this is just, it's just the determination. So the policy is actually a lot longer than this because they have a lot of the, oh, well, we heard from so-and-so, and then we discussed this, but then the CRTC decided that. So that's what I mean by determinations. These are actually the binding parts of the policy. The Native Broadcasting Policy was written, put together in 1990 through a paper comment process. So as Jodi was talking about going to the CRTC and having a public hearing and meeting commissioners face-to-face and being part of that process, that's not what happened to develop this policy. People were allowed to make submissions, written submissions, to inform this policy. In part, it's because this policy is rooted in the Native Northern Broadcasting Policy, and so it became the Native Broadcasting Policy. So there were previous public hearings that informed the older policy, but the revised, then in 1990, new Native Broadcasting Policy didn't have that same kind of public hearing process. So that makes this policy a little bit different. This policy is also different because of the way it's written. Like I was telling you, there's a lot of the conversation and the determinations. When you look at CRTC policy today, they will have that kind of record of the conversation at the top, and then they put the policy determination separated out at the bottom. So if you want to know what applies to you, you go to the bottom and you look at the policy, the actual policy. That's not the way this one is written. So it makes it very hard to navigate when you want to have a discussion about revising the policy. So that's why I've excerpted the determinations here, and you have the link to the full text if you want to go and review that. So what I'd like to do is just give you a few minutes to read through this. It's a four-page document if you're looking at the English version. Maybe we'll let you sit with it for about 8 minutes just to have a chance to review it. If anything stands out to you as a conversation point, maybe put a star by that. Note what you'd like to ask or comment on there, because this is just a sharing space discussion. We're not going to rewrite the policy now, but we want to hear from you about what stands out about the policy. And you'll note this was 1990. This is pre-internet. Right? Yeah. So there's a lot of potential for innovating this policy. It is. It has been in the three-year plan for the last four editions of the three-year plan, including the current edition. And according to the current three-year plan, they say that they're going to review what they call the Indigenous Radio Policy in 2018, so next year. So it's great that we're having this process now, because everything that we're collecting throughout the country, as well as in Ottawa, will be presented to the Commission in an intervention, in addition to developing a terms of reference for anybody else that cares to refer to what came out of this process. I also passed around the questions from the call for proposals, as well as the discussion questions with regard to the CRTC process and the policy. So those questions are the second set just right here. How would you like the CRTC consultation process to be conducted? How should the policy, how should the review process in and of itself be changed? What should the policy entail, so the Native Broadcasting Policy that's there, what should it include? What are the elements to include or exclude? What changes would be required to the Broadcasting Act? So this is separate than the policy. The Act is a piece of legislation, you know, through which the CRTC has developed this policy to apply that legislation to its work. So how should the Broadcasting Act, which is sort of the big head honcho of the world of regulation, because it's the law, how should that in itself be revised to ensure that the policy is upheld? So if you haven't looked at the 1991 Broadcasting Act, there's at least two places that mention Aboriginal peoples, and that's the language that's used. One is declaring that Aboriginal people have a special place in the broadcasting system. And this comes out of years of work and advocacy to distinguish Aboriginal people from multiculturalism and other ethnic communities in Canada. And a lot of that history is lost, I think, in terms of the current discussions around these policies, right? We don't necessarily have the background of the advocacy, the 20 years of activism from ethnic communities, from women, from Indigenous peoples, pushing to make sure that the Broadcasting Act has the things that it has. So for example, women, ethnic peoples, people with disabilities, Aboriginal peoples are guaranteed employment in the system. As I mentioned, Aboriginal peoples have a special place in the broadcasting system. And the Broadcasting Act also says that Aboriginal media will have funding when and if that becomes available. So it doesn't really guarantee funding, but it says it will have funding when and if that becomes available. So those questions are guiding our discussion today. Do you have any recommendations on the process? You heard a bit about CRTC processes today from Jody and her experience appearing for a license, but we're thinking about the review of the policy in and of itself. How should that happen? We heard some ideas. Jody had mentioned going out into communities and engaging face-to-face is critical to be part of that process. And then the policy itself, if you have ideas, again, this predates the internet, this, you know, predates a lot of the amazing work that's happening now. Based on the conversations that you've heard today, how would you like to see the policy revised? So again, this is just a conversation. You can throw out ideas, you can throw out questions, but just give me a moment to walk over to you with the microphone so that we can continue the conversation by recording the conversation today, okay? So, thoughts, comments, questions? Folks in the room?
My name is Jane Arscott. I did work for the CRTC back in the early 1980s.
Okay, so you were around for some time.
Yeah, and what was interesting was at the time the issues were a more robust Canadian content, equity in availability of services, especially in the north, with the satellite launches being the technological solution that was going to provide equity. But on the horizon was the 500 channel universe,
yeah,
and the possibility that telecommunications would become ubiquitous. So when I read the native broadcasting policy that's 27 years old, it's not that much different from the way that we were thinking about things in the early 80s. And so what this tells me is that the policy reach is not far enough out from the present to really get a sense that we don't know what the future holds, but if this policy is going to be around for 30 years, then it should be designed around youth, because they're the only they're going to be the ones who are going to be revising it the next time. And so to change the focus of the policy process to try to really focus on what youth are doing with technology and the broadcast medium and communications, that's probably a better footing to base a policy on than the current problems as identified by mature broadcasters. So it's about trying to catch the wave of what's coming next and to frame the policy in a broad enough way that you keep hold of some ongoing principles like equity, change, resilience, and maybe using language that's a little more generic but forward-looking would help to position the policy for whatever happens, even if we can't say technologically what it's going to be. So for example, we weren't thinking about the marriage of communications and telecommunications. We were thinking of broadcasting as continuing to be the primary activity, and yet no, now telecommunications is part of what we consider broadcasting to be. So it's expanding the policy framework to try to capture more of what is relevant today for creating equity in communications. Thanks.
That was fabulous. Thanks for starting that out.
Yeah.
Other thoughts, comments, ideas?
And I wanted to reflect on it from, I'm coming from a telecommunications background, telecommunications policy background, and you know, that idea of focusing on what can be done with these tools as opposed to the tools or the technologies themselves. So I remember, you know, with the telecom, the basic service objective, like what should be that basic standard of service for telecom, and there was a lot of discussion about, you know, speeds, upload speeds, download speeds, should it be fiber, should it be satellite, like that kind of stuff. And the outcome of those discussions was actually, what can you do with it? How does it deliver? So it should be adequate to support the delivery of health or education or economic development opportunities or that kind of thing. So I could see a similar argument maybe getting made for content, as you say. You know, it's not about delivering maybe radio or TV or podcasting, but, you know, the provision of cultural content and language revitalization or something, like a broad, as you're saying, like a broader kind of use-focused approach. Anyway, just wanted to echo that. I thought that was a great way of framing it.
One of the things that is happening now is that with online delivery of government services, there is the expectation that everyone will be able to access their government through the technology. And in order to do that, you need to have a cell phone, or you need to have the internet, or you need to be able to do your some level of service online. And it's not just interface with government, it's also healthcare provision at a distance and education delivery. So there are a lot of sort of services that we will want to have delivered using the broadcast policy, and it's very important that an Indigenous perspective be integral to those developments. So the policy in part has to be expansive in terms of not simply narrow casting to local communities, but inflecting the service delivery model that is used by large-scale providers of health, education, welfare, commercial undertakings. It's just the whole, everything. Because if you don't capture that, the Indigenous aspect of the policy will become narrower and narrower and tinier, and we don't want that to happen. What we want to do is we want to flip it so that the Indigenous perspective is influencing the main provision of those kinds of services, not just in the North, but to all Canadians and Canadians abroad. So, you know, it's kind of a, I'm talking about kind of inverting the way that it has gone in the past. So that then this isn't a specialty service, it's a, what's special about it is that it has the capacity to influence the way the entire operation is done. And that would really be empowering for Indigenous voices and perspectives.
If you look at page 19 to 21, the line numbers on the first page, it says the Commission recognizes that subject to broad CRTC objectives and to statutory requirements, it is the, quote, Aboriginal broadcast, I'm quoting the whole thing, anyway, it is the Aboriginal broadcasters themselves who are best qualified to determine and meet the needs of their audiences. And so I feel like the policy is trying to build in some of the sentiment that you just said, but it would be interesting to try to extend that further and say what that means, because here it says Aboriginal broadcasters, and you were speaking more from communities, like people on the ground. And we heard the comment earlier about going to communities, and perhaps this sentiment about broadcasters is expecting the broadcasters to kind of carry forward whatever the communities on the ground want. I don't know what's the assumption here, but maybe that needs to be fleshed out when the policy is reviewed about what that means and how that happens.
That term broadcasters too, is that the right term still, or does that need to be expanded as whether it's content creators or whether it's, you know, digital, I don't know. Do you want to limit it to digital media or, I don't know, does that, I want to, I'm just kind of pushing against like that idea, like, because I know that the government's planning to review the Broadcasting Act and Telecom Act too, so there's probably going to be some discussion there around the term broadcasting, so.
Yeah, like were these podcasters today that we heard from, are they broadcasters?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's
fine. Going back to when this was put in place and looking at the changes now, personally, I'd like to begin with the premise that Aboriginal broadcasters are Canada's second national broadcaster. And I think that no matter how you proceed in amending, changing, adding, creating, that the policy that you end up with has to be strategically worded to reflect the future and those people who are going to be looking at this years from now. And I say that because too often in government policies are blanket statements. Take, for example, on the roles of objectives, it's essential that Aboriginal broadcasters receive sufficient funds. So who defines what sufficient is, you know? And is that really the right word? Those kinds of things have to be built in, because, you know, it's one of those things where it's anybody's definition. And we've dealt with that, you know, on numerous occasions with Heritage Canada on how they are the ones that perceive what it is that we should be doing. And the statement that Gretchen read out, where Aboriginal broadcasters themselves are best qualified to determine and meet the needs of their audiences. That sounds really good, but that's not the way it is. Heritage Canada right now determines, you know, through funding and through, you know, their rules and procedures, what is best for our audience, because we don't have that capacity in dealing with them. I think you have to look at this policy in a number of different ways, and attack it in that sense, where it's you know, the statement and whatever. You have to look at technology in a different light as well, because that wasn't necessarily reflected on previously. Satellites, for example, what happens when a satellite burns out? I mean, who's responsible for that? What capacity can we have within that satellite itself? Technical innovation has to be, you know, put in there and reflected. We can't define what's going to be down the road 10 years from now, but certainly we can come up with the words that would accommodate Aboriginal broadcasters. Because the situation we're dealing with now, I mean, it's horrendous when we're looking at, in some cases, you know, equipment that's between 25 and 30 years old. I mean, what the CBC throws away today is newer than anything that we have, you know. So that kind of thing has to be put in there so that, you know, we're on an even keel. As it stands, in my determination, and I've discussed this legally too, in legal arguments, where the Government of Canada and, you know, the Minister of Heritage are guilty of systemic discrimination or systemic racism based on how they handle Aboriginal broadcasters, where you have the CBC under the same umbrella receive certain amount of money, and Aboriginal broadcasters receive this amount for what it is you do, which, you know, it's pretty much the same. And I say that, and I'll give you an example where I had a lady working for me as a Chippewa announcer, and spent a number of years with us. CBC needed somebody that was Chippewa, so they threw a ton of money at her. So instead of making the $40,000 with CKLB, she makes $90,000 with CBC, doing exactly the same job. But we're not funded in that same way by Heritage Canada when they dole out what they do to the CBC and what they give to us. So those kinds of things we have to do away with. We also, if we're going to be going ahead with revamping a national Aboriginal broadcast policy, then please, before we do that, let's bring some of the North into the future, so we're on the same wavelength when we're discussing something like this. I mean, some of the North and, you know, areas of Nunavut, for example, are still, and it's no fault of their own, you know. And again, I reflect in the comment I made earlier to somebody when we were talking, is that a lot of the time, as Northerners, we're penalized for where we live, you know, even though, according to Canada, it's a strategic part, you know, of sovereignty. And that's not always reflected in how the government deals with us, or how the government, or the rest of Canada, for that matter, treats us. There has to be a degree of protection in how this policy down the road may be looked at. You don't want, you know, something like an Aryan-minded Harper administration to come in and make, you know, significant negative change to something that you're hanging your hat on. And a lot of times policy is, if the mind is right, it's easy to change. And there has to be, you know, something put in there that requires certain steps before anything significant is changed within a new policy. I think that's good enough for now.
This is going to be on the panel at 2:30 with Rob and Michael, so we can hear more.